I'm not switching my team to some fancy work platform that somehow knows exactly how we work. And its AI features are literally saving us hours every day. Oh, we're big fans. And just like that, teams all around the world are falling for Monday.com. With intuitive design, seamless AI capabilities, and custom workflow, it's the work platform your team will instantly click with. Head to Monday.com, the first work platform you'll love to use.
You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name's Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 234 is John Kruth, who plays many instruments and so has particularly been in demand as a session musician playing mandolin and flute with the Violent Femmes, the Reptile Palace Orchestra, Die Kreuzen, other artists, and he has released around 24 albums. You are right now hearing Grim Reaper's song from his first solo album, Midnight Snack, from 1987. He's well known as the co-leader of the New York City world music ensemble Tribecistan, which released 5 albums and 2 EPs between 2009 and 2015. We're going to talk about the song Be Careful What You Say to an Armed Lady by Folklorchestra, which is more or less a continuation of Tribecistan. The album is A Strange Day in June from 2023. Then we'll look back to one of his recent solo albums, Forever Ago, 2018, and talk about the title track from that. Then back to Bedbugs by Tribecistan from New Delhi, 2012. And we'll conclude by listening to a 1995 track called Backcountry, attributed to The Electric Chairman from their album Toast, which is John and a bunch of people from Camper Van Beethoven. For more information, please see kruthworks.com or look up John or Tribecistan on Bandcamp. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or get this episode entirely ad-free, plus access to my document with lyrics and structures and notes on these songs at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I'll play a little bit of Grim Reaper's song from your first solo album, 1987's Midnight Snack. We're going to jump to the present, but there's a lot of stuff in between, and it seems like you are a real multi-hyphenate. So if we're just picking 3, 4, 5 songs for this, you know, that's only a fraction of the styles, even the instruments that you play. Can you say a little about that journey? I mean, there, you know, a ton of solo albums before we're going to get to even founding Tribecistan.
Well, I started on guitar and harmonica like most kids my age, learning folk songs and all of that. And around the time I was 15 years old, my sister was dating this very kind of cool beatnik slash hippie, proto-hippie, who played blues harmonica. And I used to play with him a bit. And then he had a mandolin, and it was the first time I ever heard or really saw a mandolin, and he was playing kind of like pseudo gypsy Irish tunes on it, and I just thought that was the coolest. And that was before I even heard Bill Monroe. I think the first mandolin I heard recorded was on Dr. John's Gree-Gree on Dance Kalinda Daboom Maboom. It just seemed so exotic, and everybody had a guitar. There was always going to be a guitar when I got there. He also used to come over to make out with my sister and listen to Herbie Mann records. And man, I just thought that was incredible. And I got a flute despite the fact that my brother called me a fairy and my father was rolling his eyes. And
come on, Jethro Tull's a thing. It's not unprecedented.
Well, they weren't happening yet.
Okay. All right. So what year are you talking about? This is
64.
Okay.
You know, I got a flute in like 1964. I mean, the Beatles were happening and I loved that and I played guitar, but I heard like My Kind of Groove and Live at the Village Gate, and I looked at that guy and I thought, I even kind of look like that guy, you know? I was like, wow, this is kind of hip. It's jazz and you just make it up yourself. So suddenly I was playing like harmonica and guitar and I had the flute. I was a big fan of the Rolling Stones, and Brian Jones was my guy. And I used to buy Rolling Stones records just to see what Brian was going to play on the next record. You know, Under My Thumb with the marimba, and Ruby Tuesday had the recorder, and then the sitar on Paint It Black. And yes, I play sitar. And so that started putting me on the road to multi-instrumentalism. And then I heard the Incredible String Band and Russ on Roland Kirk, who I wrote my first book about. And I thought, okay, you use instruments as color. It's just like a palette. It's a sonic palette. So I became the guy that, like, when bands were playing around town, I'd get up and play flute with them on a Jethro Tull or a Traffic song.
The utility player, I believe.
Infield utility player. I mean, I always kind of did my own thing, but I kind of got a reputation as the go-to guy if, oh, you need like a banjo. Well, Kruth could play a banjo. He could also play flute and mandolin and harmonica. And later on, I played sitar. And even though I'm a decent guitar player, nobody ever called me to play guitar because, hey, you know, there are always plenty of guitar players around. So, I mean, I wound up playing with Violent Femmes and members of Camper Van Beethoven and Allen Ginsberg and all kinds of people. Peter Stample from Holy Modal Rounders and I had a duet with, and then Sam Shepard joined us for a while. I've never learned how to speak Spanish or French or Italian very well, but employing various instruments, it's like speaking different languages. And so, yeah, I speak flute fluently, and I can even speak some saxophone and clarinet and, you know, give me a sitar. And I've been playing, you know, 20 years now, and I'm still a beginner, but I can play fiddle. I don't know. I just have this thing that I saw Brian Jones doing it, and I thought, I can do that. So I'm a polymath that way. You know, I have that ability.
All right. So even what I had identified as your ancient history, your first solo album, sounds like you were already doing it for 20 years, playing with other people before that.
I started when I was about 15 or 16. I had a couple of my own bands around town. But I was always eclectic with a capital E. It always seemed like I was always outside the norm, even when I thought this is pretty normal. But, you know, what do I know? So, like, you know, if my friend's band was playing, I'd go ahead and sit in with them. And then, like, I wound up sitting in with people. I played with John Prine, just a lot of different people over the years. And Violent Femmes, that was a really big... That was really when things really started to open up.
Was that like during their second album when they had more back?
Right before the second album, they were in New York and they were playing at Folk City and I went to see them and I went up to Brian Ritchie and I just said, wow, this is really great. You guys are on fire. And I said, what are you listening to? And he said, Sun Ra, Captain Beefheart, Nick Drake. I can tell you as a guy that was playing in Greenwich Village in the 80s, nobody listened to Nick Drake. The only reason I knew about Nick Drake was because Joe Boyd produced them, and I bought anything that Joe Boyd produced, and Richard Thompson played guitar on Nick Drake's first album, and I was a Richard Thompson fan. So it was like, okay, so I started playing some with the Violent Femmes, and I wound up playing with the Meat Puppets, and De Kreutzen, which is a hardcore band from Milwaukee, produced by Butch Vig. And then I ran into Hal Wilner. And once I ran into Hal Wilner, then I had a whole nother show right there.
Let me fast forward you a little just so we get to the music quick. So we'll talk about the founding of Tribecistan. We're going to mostly just talk about things from the last 20 years or so. Nothing further back than that, the songs that we picked. We're going to start with the most recent thing that you're pushing. That is the Folk Orchestra, which is the current version, as you were saying, of Tribecistan. We'll sort of talk about that journey. Yeah, so that even though you're a multi-instrumentalist, well, let's get, if you're going to have oboe, oboe's really hard. Let's get a really good oboe player. Let's really, you know, and really have a really coherent unit. Yeah, can you say a little about where you're at with this album, A Strange Day in June? The song I had picked from it was Be Careful What You Say to an Armed Lady. So let's briefly introduce that project and then we'll play it in full and then we'll talk in more detail.
I wrote a grant for the Chamber Music of America, not thinking that I had a chance. What do I know about chamber music? But I knew a cellist and I knew an oboe player, Kathy Halverson, who played earlier on a Tribecistan album. And out of the blue, I got this grant to make a new album. Tribecistan had crashed and burned over the course of maybe 10 years we were together, 5 albums and 2 Christmas EPs. Mm-hmm. It had really run its course. We had played in Russia, in Germany, in Czech, and in California and in Canada. We toured with that band. It was anywhere between 7 and 10 pieces, depending on the size of the horn section. And I won this grant, and it was like, well, how am I going to make chamber music? Let's see. I'll call up Gideon. He plays cello, and Kathy plays oboe, and Premier Russell Tubbs, who played with Mahavishnu Orchestra and Santana, is a really great flute player and reed player, and also played lap steel. Everybody in the band was a previous member or recorded with Tribecistan. So I basically took the people that I had the most fun and enjoyed playing with the best and wrote a bunch of new material. Now, right in the middle of this, I had a heart problem and had 4 stents in my heart and was in bed. And Kathy would come over and write everything out. I'd sit there with my mandolin and my penny whistle. You know, it's like the scene with Mozart and Salieri, you know? She was sitting there, and I think maybe these guys thought, this is it. This might be the last go-round with Kruth here, because I had no breath control. I barely played flute on the album myself, just a little bit of harmonica, and really wrote and arranged that record more than participated quite that much in the playing. I only have a couple of solos on the album. I had 1 foot off the ground when we made that record, but I'm really proud of the album. It's beautiful. And I don't know what Chamber Music of America thought about it. They never really said much after I sent them a copy of it.
There's active mandolin through a lot of the songs. So I think we're apart from the harmonica as well. Well, let's, yeah, any comments in particular about this? Be careful what you say to an armed lady before we hear it.
Okay, there's a few funny things about it. Now, one of them, okay, it's not so funny that I'm playing 12-string guitar, but basically that's what I'm playing on that song. And the funny thing is it quotes Beethoven's Fifth. And it quotes Beethoven's Fifth because at one point, Gordon Gaynor, who has a very dry sense of humor, Gordon from the Violent Femmes, says to me, I hate your music. I go, really? I go, you've even played with me, Gordon. You've recorded with me. Since when do you hate my music? He goes, it reminds me of Beethoven. You're always making the same kind of chord changes and stuff that Beethoven made. And I go, so right in the middle of this tune, it goes, in it. And that's a tribute to Gordon.
That's a good impression. Let's get this going here. We'll be right back.
everything on the Folklore Orchestra was recorded live. I would say it's about 90-95% live because we rehearsed and rehearsed. I wanted to do it live. But I went through some real health challenges between 2023 and 2024. I haven't been playing a lot. I'm recording, but I haven't been playing very much out because I don't want to get really into that. But I went through a 4 stents in the heart and all of that.
So this was played live out of necessity, or you're saying it was played because...
No, it wasn't played live out of necessity. It was played live because I wanted to be able to take this band out and play it as live as possible. It's chamber, it's neo chamber music. There's very few effects on the record. There's a total lack of reverb on the record. Mm. I wanted it to sound like chamber music, except it's somewhere between I don't know what it is. I'm just playing music that I hear in my head and that I write and that I put together. I mean, it's the way it's always been on all of my records, whether they're John Kruth records or Villa Delirium or Folklore Orchestra or whatever Kruth conglomeration I have put together.
So we start out with this kind of Cajun drone. Yeah, can you say a little about just the choice of which ethnic music styles you're bringing in? I mean,
there's reasons for it. Duke Ellington used to say that he wrote for the members of his band, and I was really writing for the people in this band. It starts off with Kenny Margolis, who's arguably the best or one of the best accordion players in New York. He's on Le Chat Bleu by Mink DeVille, which is, to me, an absolutely stunning record. And he is the go-to guy for playing a squeeze box in New York City, played with Cracker and Smithereens. And I haven't made a record without Kenny in 10 years or something. I mean, he's a great keyboard player. And so where was I going to put that Cajun accordion? So it's like I had to find a place for it. And it's like, let's kick this tune off with it and then come back around to it in the middle of it for a solo. So I always think about the people that I'm playing with. There's all kinds of spots on that album that I wrote specifically for Kathy Halverson's oboe.
Yeah, she's going to come in here as well. So at the beginning, is the percussion, is that washboard or guiro, or do you even recall?
That's a washboard in there. That's Boris Kinberg, who also played with Willie DeVille and was a member of Tribecistan for maybe 5 years.
And you do have a little bit of studio effect in that your harmonica comes in on the left side and then it shifts over.
Mixing. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So is that really down home sound that you get on harmonica? I mean, is that an effect on it, or that's just actually what is coming out of in the room?
That's just the way I play.
Okay. Well, it's nice and dirty. I like it. I mean, sometimes it would add distortion or something like that, to get it to that level. I guess the song that we're going to play at the end has a little bit of the sort of Jay Giles Band 70s feel. And sometimes your voice does that. So I don't know if Magic Dick, that was an influence.
Oh, yeah, but they were cool. I was a big fan, of course, of Butterfield when I was a teenager and listened to a lot of blues. And when I went to art school in Minneapolis in the 70s, I thought I was going to wind up just playing harmonica with blues guys to make a living. But I'm a lightweight. I can't really drink or smoke much. And that lifestyle really didn't appeal to me. So I got out of it pretty quickly. But the music always really, I got to play with Gatemouth Brown and Albert Collins and a number of great blues men. That's a 12-string guitar. Camper and I shared a lot of stuff, a lot of musical vocabulary. I think I met them in 88. I opened for them at an outdoor festival in Milwaukee. And Jonathan and Victor came up to me right away and said, we want to put out your album on. No, that must have been 86 because Midnight Snack came out in 86. Mm. They wanted to put out Midnight Snack. And they came right up to me. And I mean, when I saw them and they saw me, it was like, wow, we just connected right away. I still play with Victor Krumenacher all the time. And Jonathan Siegel and Krumenacher were in one of my more recent bands called the Illustrious Ancestors. Love those guys. And I play it on their records and they play on mine. And so that keeps going.
Well, so do you know where this, the common ancestor, this no, like it sounds like it's pulling some, again, not Cajun, but some other Middle Eastern ethnic thing. Or do you even think of those terms? Or it's just, you know, it's just a melody?
No, I don't think of those terms until they later appear. Sometimes all of a sudden I go, ah, that's kind of like Jimmy Page, I guess. Or, you know, I loved Led Zeppelin III. That was my Led Zeppelin jam. So I love Led Zeppelin III, and there were always elements to me of, but no, I don't think in those terms at all. The music just kind of flows from one form into the next.
Well, that was, you know, because I got into Camper Van Beethoven in college and the gypsy violin and things. I was kind of wondered if it was more college guys screwing around with what to them sound like foreign sounds, which is completely respectable. Like that's what the Beatles did, or whether it was more of an actual musicology thing, like, you know, Steely Span or whatever, you know, who's studying.
I understand. And maybe subliminally it is. I'm older than those guys. Mm-hmm. And I think I was exposed to a lot of performers that they didn't see.
Sure.
Live. I'm like 10 years older than those guys. When I was coming up in New York, there was Robert Browning had his world music shows at Greenwich Village at the church. And so I saw a lot of different stuff. And as my mother pointed out, she was like, you know,
breaking up is never easy. But saying goodbye to your old clunky work tools, well, that's easy. Just repeat after me. It's not me. It's definitely you. You rigid, unfriendly software. It's time to freshen things up with Monday.com, the first work platform you'll love to use. With stunning dashboards, customizable templates, and built-in AI that actually works, switching to a new work platform has never felt this good. So move on to Monday.com.
Well, John, we never listened to this kind of music around the house. How did you ever come across this? And I said, a lot of those melodies are DNA. I really believe that a lot of that stuff was DNA. And I'm Hungarian and Russian in background. I've played in Hungary and I've played in Russia.
Well, this is why I thought, I know you've done these Croatian albums that you had the musicology thing, the I'm going to hunt out.
I don't think about it that way, though. I'm a stumbler. I'm really a stumbler that stumbles, meets somebody, and they've got a violin, or they've got a nickel harpa, or they've got, like when I met Jeff Green, when we started Tribecistan, he had the biggest instrument collection I'd ever seen in one house before, and he didn't even own a guitar, because he was kind of anti-guitar. He was a little bit of a snob that way. And so that's how Tribecistan started, because he had all of these different instruments. And me thinking right away, the sonic palette, how can I employ this into that song or that sound? I mean, you know, growing up, Brian Jones put out the Master Musicians of Shizuoka. That record to me was just as important as, like, I don't know, Moon Dance or something by Van Morrison. You know, I mean, that was on the same level. I always went to see Ravi Shankar. Every chance I got, I met him and got to talk with him. And when I was lucky enough for a while to study with Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
Ornette Coleman told me, and this almost made me bust into tears. He said, you didn't choose the mandolin. And I said, really? And he goes, the mandolin chose you. to play us ancient melodies through. And I said, Ornette, I truly believe that because I play stuff that I've never heard before. I don't know where this stuff is coming from, and I think it's DNA.
So I will link folks to, like, say, your Noodle Shop EP with Jonathan Segel that has some of that Ornette Coleman influence, the more free jazz. This song, even though still instrumental, being a chamber piece, is quite organized. It's got, here's your A section, here's your B section, that I could pretty easily chart this out.
This was written music. A Noodle Shop, we met that day at the recording studio, and whatever we played in a period of 3 hours was edited down to a 90, 75-minute CD.
To go back to the Armed Lady, right, you've played the da-da-da-da-da-da a few times. About the third time, let me play where you add that faith, da-da-da-da-da, that rhythm here. Yeah, so we're going to have that riff and then use the, any thoughts about that choice of movement to then get out, and we're going to have these periodic bump, bump, bump punctuation pauses before we get to the next section.
You're great, man. You're really great. I don't know if I ever thought about it other than this seems to work, and the tablisher sounded good right there. You know, he's a great tabla player, and it was so cool to put together a band without a drummer and use tabla.
I was going to ask you about that because it seems like a number of your things there, you're avoiding full drum kit. Is that sort of, that it's always more interesting to have?
Well, it was chamber music, so it had to be lighter. The feel had to be lighter, and Roland is just a wonder. He's a great drummer, too. He was on, if you go and listen to Cole Again by Tribeca Stan, the Christmas album, he's on there, and he's a fantastic drummer. One of my favorite pieces, by the way, of Tribeca Stan is, what's the name of that Ukrainian?
Carol the Bells.
Carol the Bells. Listen to that sometime. It's going to blow you away. It's like King Crimson. That's the closest I've ever come to King Crimson before. And right before we started the tune, I'll just tell you how I direct a band. Right before we played that song, I said, I want it to sound like Guernica.
Okay.
You know, the Picasso painting?
Yes.
And it does. You'll hear it, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, you're rolling your eyes and the engineer was rolling his eyes and every, you know, but if enough of the form is there, then it's very important to abandon it. I mean, I learned this from Ornette. I knew it before I met Ornette to a certain degree, but playing with Ornette over the course of a few years at his home, there were a couple of Tribeca Stan albums that he actually kind of shaped and listened to. I couldn't believe he gave me that kind of time. He was a dear, dear, sweet, beautiful man.
Well, some of what makes, you know, King Crimson, King Crimson, right? The song Red, one of my favorite tunes, is that it's riff oriented. It seems like overall you're not as much a chord guy as a riff guy. Certainly if you're writing on flute, you know, it's going to be
right.
Melodic riffs. Let me jump us forward to the nice open strummed section.
That's where I told him to make it sound like, I think, Atlantis. I think I said, yeah, make it sound like Donovan here. I want it to be like Atlantis.
It's the light opening up this beautiful...
Exactly what I said.
And there's no substitute on there for, you know, if you're going to have an oboe player, to have somebody who actually has the sort of orchestral chops, because it's so different than a tin whistle or something that... I could get an okay sound out of a tin whistle, but like an oboe, I'm not going near because that is,
right.
That's hard.
I tried it for a while. It's really hard. I mean, I was a huge fan and was really lucky to be in Yusef Lateef's presence and talk with him a number of times. He was another beautiful, dear, gentle, the gentle giant, as he was known. And Yusef, some of his oboe playing is just absolutely the Pichette. When you hear him play Sister Mamie, or his oboe playing was fantastic. And I would say to Miss Halverson to please listen to Yusef and, you know, see if you can grab a little bit of his flavor in here.
Let us stop to talk about our sponsor, Function Health. I chose Function Health because it's the only health platform that gives you access to the kind of data most people never see and the insights to actually take action. Inside Function, you can test over 160 biomarkers from heart and hormones to toxins, inflammation, and stress. You can also access multi-region MRI and CT scans, all tracked in one secure place over time. It's a near 360 view to see what's happening in your body. And that's why top health leaders are all behind Function Health. Let's talk about the summer grind. The sun is up longer, you sleep shorter, pressure of summer social activities, low energy, fragile mood, libido MIA. Function helps you find the signals under the symptoms, putting names and numbers to crashes no one can see. So you'll get information about your testosterone levels, your cortisol levels, your vitamin D and magnesium levels, among the nearly 30 biomarkers that can impact your skin. Seeking information about what's off is the first step to getting yourself back. Function is the first health membership giving you access to over 100 biomarkers across the whole body, hormones, metabolism, inflammation, heart, liver, and more, tracked over time, explained in plain language. To give just one important example, knowing your glucose and insulin level can tell you about blood sugar swings that trigger breakouts and inflammation. So you've been in the sun a lot, your skin is talking. Function is going to help you stop blaming skincare products and start understanding the patterns, because your skin is a mirror and Function gives you the data to read it. Learn more and join using my link, functionhealth.com/nakedly. First 1,000 people on there will get $100 credit toward their membership. Again, it's functionhealth.com/nakedly, or use the gift code nakedly at sign up to own your health.
So in terms of the orchestration and actually determining there, okay, well, here's where the oboe is going and here's where the clarinet is going. Is it just that there's few enough of them? It's not that there's dozens of them that you could just arrange this just the way you would a rock band or something? Or was this, well, the fact that you were in a bed semi-dictating this, I'm sort of picturing like when Paul McCartney wrote classical music, it was, he's doing his la, 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 and his orchestra friend is who's done millions of these.
Yeah, I was writing, I wrote everything on mandolin and penny whistle. I couldn't really play much flute at that time because I didn't have breath control. Mm-hmm. It was really funny. We got through the most of the songs, and the title song I had written on a mandocello, which is a baritone mandolin. Mm-hmm. And I think that either Ray Peterson, who was the bass player, who played with Eddie Harris, an incredible bass player, I think Ray or I'm trying to remember who said to me, there's not a mandocello song on this record, man. And I said, oh, you know, well, oh, it was Kathy. And I said, well, I wrote this waltz. I don't know. What do you think about it? And I started to play it for her. And she said, I think that might be the best song on the album. That might be my favorite song. And so we worked out A Strange Day in June. It's on a bass clarinet and mandocello. And it's just a beautiful, haunting sound that you don't hear every day. And she comes in with that incredible opening lick that was just stunning. And so I thought, well, okay, this is close enough for chamber music. These guys shouldn't be too upset that they gave me the grant.
Prepping for this did get me watching videos of mandolas and mandocellos and things, because it's not, you know, I own a mandolin. I'm not good at it, but I only use it because I want to add a little high texture. I want to add that really tinkly thing. But then I hadn't really gotten my head around, like, if I'm recording stuff with acoustic guitar and 12 string and whatnot, of like, well, bringing in make a case why I should purchase a mandocello, but what fundamentally different thing this adds. I guess if I learn to play mandolin well enough, then maybe I'll look at a mandola.
You know, maybe listen to my album Gourd Splitter, which has a song. I mean, mandocello is really funky, man. You can play the funkiest stuff on it. People don't remember that Jaco Pastorius played mandocello on Birdland. it's just got a bottom. Part of playing the mandolin for me is that it's in fifths and it's not in fourths. And there's an open string thing that you can do on a mandolin that doesn't happen on a guitar in the same way. And I play mandolin coming from a Yank Rochelle Rycruder corner, not from, well, I love Bill Monroe and I'm not knocking him, but I don't come from that bluegrass background. I can't play bluegrass mandolin. I don't get that sound out of the instrument. And then when I started spending more time in Eastern Europe, I started, you know, picking up more nuances of that music. You know, that's just where that comes from. But I mean, like the Grim Reaper song, which you played a little bit of, man, I wrote that riff when I was maybe 20 years old or 21 years old or something. It was just a little riff I played on the mandolin.
Well, and you're stumbling across, I guess with any new instrument, it sort of writes a couple riffs for you that your hands or your mouth that, oh, I got a new song out of just playing around, even with a new synth sound that sometimes I can do that with. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the real joy of skipping from one to the next. Now, you know, I am the jack. I am just a jack of various trades. I am really not a master of any. What I'm good at is putting it all together. And I think that's why I wound up working with Hal Wilner a bit and being the music director for a couple of his live shows. And I think he dug my eclecticism. And I think that's how I've managed to fit in with whether hardcore bands or I was in India and I played at a rave for about 8 or 10,000 people in India with this guy, Anoop, DJ Absolute Anoop. Bangalore, India, playing flute with dancing images of Krishna and Ganesh behind. And it's all language. It's all a conversation. And the instrument, if you're willing to dance, if you can work at it enough. Now, here's one of the things that a lot of people always say to me. Well, that's hard. That's hard. I can't play that instrument. It's hard. And then I go, oh, well, then go watch your TV or go sit on your computer. Because here's the thing. I have spent many hours not watching TV, not being on the computer unless I was writing something with instruments and working it out on various instruments. I know I have a natural ability for that, but the fiddle still kicks my ass after 40 years.
Which is funny because, you know, that you have the left hand more or less from mandolin. So it's just actually.
Yeah, but there's no frets and you're holding it completely different. And it's absolutely the opposite ergonomically of the flute. You know, the fiddle's over here, the flute's over here. I mean, I think that our brains are really only designed to do so much. If I had started fiddle when I was maybe 5, it would have been natural for me, but it's always been a kind of an unnatural instrument.
Well, that's what I was wondering about. The reason that mandolin, it's okay that it's in fifths is because the frets are so small to get close together. So you can still, with your four fingers, reach all the way and do a scale without moving positions. But I would think if you move to a mandocello, then just doing a scale,
a unless
you're
going to use
open,
game,
open strings, then you're jumping... You're jumping around.
Big jump. Big jump. But I love the mandocello. There's nothing like it. I mean, I used it all over Tribecistan. It's been on my albums since my third album in 1990, Banshee Mandolin. There's a lot of mandocello on that record.
Let's get another song out here. I want to do something a little more traditional singer-songwriter. One of the ones you had picked out that you said was one of your favorites was the title track from Forever Ago, your 2018 solo album with La Società de Musici. I'm butchering my Italian. Musici.
I'll let you butcher it because I'll just, you know.
Well, you dealt with the people. You know how it's supposed to be pronounced, right?
They are such a wonderful bunch of people and a great band from Spoleto. I had worked with Liz Suedos, who was one of the great directors of off-Broadway and experimental theater in New York. I worked theater for quite a while because I could play 3 or 4 instruments. You know, it would be really great for them. Okay, I'll pick up a mandolin here and a flute there. And you want a banjo or you want a harmonica? What do you want? Guitar? What do you want? And so like in a theater setting, I often had a lot of work in that way because I could just pick up different stuff. I worked with Liz Suedos, who was just great. I loved Liz and her spirit and a really brilliant outside of the box thinker. And she brought in this guy, Claudio Scarabattini from Spoleto, Italy, where La Mama, who is on 4th Street in New York, also has a theater in Italy. And we became immediate friends. And he was like, you've got to come to Italy and play with my friends in this band.
Sorry, is he playing? I see in the credits here that he plays Neapolitan mandolin. Is he actually playing the mandolin on this song and not you?
There's three mandolin players on this song.
I knew there was the tremolo in both ears at various points. Okay, so you're doing it together.
Yeah, there's three mandolin players on that song. I think Maurizio might be playing I don't know if Maurizio was playing the octave mandolin on that song or if I overdubbed
I mean, it says he plays bouzouki on this. I don't know if that it was on this song in particular.
Right.
Is this a concertina instead of an accordion? What is the squeeze box on this?
Yeah, it's been a long time. Okay. You tell me what the credits says. That's Jalou. Jalou is incredible. Just, I mean, really one of the most scary, fantastic accordion players I've ever heard in my life.
Okay.
So the whole band was just excellent. And these guys lived basically, for the most part, together back in the woods. Spoleto is like Woodstock, New York. It's almost 100 miles directly north of Rome, deep woods, kind of agricultural. I felt like this was my Bob Dylan and the band moment. These guys had been playing together for years, had their own groove, had their own sound. They were backing up Massimo Liberatore, who's a wonderful singer and guitar player. And I played on his record. And then they said, okay, now we make your record. And so we made this album forever ago. And it was at Jalou's house, Jalou Bibiani. And his mother would be cooking all morning. And we would start around 10:30, 11, work till like maybe 1, have lunch, have this incredible Italian, fresh-made, beautiful lunch that Jalou's mother just made. And take a couple hours off, relax, and go back and work until late in the evening. And that's how we made that record. Day after day in the same studio, not with different people coming in and overdubbing, but everything just happening in a period of like a week. And it was just one of the greatest experiences I've ever had making music. They were a blast. I love these guys. I've played many live shows with them. I got a leftover track that's going to be on my new album. I'm out in LA right now making my new album and going to use one of those old tracks that didn't come out on that album with a couple of tracks that I also recorded with Maurizio and the Cat Gang, his band. And there's 4 songs from that album that we recorded in Italy. And now I'm out here recording with the Holy Brothers, Marvin Etzioni of Lone Justice fame, and Willie Aaron, who's worked with everybody from Leonard Cohen to Ricky Lee Jones and does his own thing. He's wonderful.
The girl with the red hair and the red dress is dancing. She's dancing in a trance on a hot July night, while the drummer is a-pounding out the poison that burns through his veins he caught from a spider bite. Under the full moon they played for some spare change in a little town square where I met you. Outside the museum the tourists have gathered, they wait patiently for the time to come for the guards to throw open the vaults of a culture that's only a shadow of what it once was. What good is Picasso Pollock or Roscoe when you're an ocean away. Well, I wanna know, where does the time go? 'Cause it feels like forever, forever ago. Now the TV is blaring in a bistro in Dubrovnik, where the old men sit around and smoke, and I wonder where it all went. Was it worth it? Was it well spent? Or were the gods playing some kind of joke? I yell laughter, it rings like the song of a siren as my little boat washes ashore. Yeah, I wanna know, where does the time go? 'Cause it feels like forever, forever ago. Yeah, I wanna know, where does the time go? 'Cause it feels like forever, forever ago. Now the girl,
la piazza, tieni i balli, quei rossi capelli, la luna, il ragno, non perdo mai.
The girl,
ballavi, ballavi, da stella, stella.
She's dancing in a trance on a hot July night.
Tarantella.
Tell you this story of that song because I wrote it and recorded it there in Italy. I played in this little town in Umbria. It was this beautiful town square in the summer, and it was very hot and humid, and there was a full moon, and there was pretty big hills around us and pine trees and everything, and a church, and we're right in the town square, and I'm playing with the my Italian brothers of that wonderful band, The Society. And opening for us was a guy playing an accordion, and I believe there was a fiddler, and a rather striking woman with red hair and a red dress. The girl with the red hair and the red dress is dancing. She's dancing whatever it was, hot summer night. I can't even remember the lyric.
Hot July night.
Hot July yes. night. Yeah. And so I'm watching this and it's really intense. And I turn to Claudio and he goes, "The Tarantella." And I said, "That's the Tarantella. That's it. It's not this Americanized version that I've seen. No, these people played and danced like they were possessed, like the drummer had been poisoned by a spider bite. Tarantula, Tarantella, Tarantula."
Okay. So, and you feature the actual Tarantella at the end of this, which, you know, something like, what made you not just do that for the main song, as opposed to this languid, sort of dreamy, nostalgic 60s?
You got it. You're explaining it all. I was, okay. You know, it was an epiphany. Ah, the girl with the red hair and the red dress is dancing, you know? And then it turned into a love song for my sweetheart who was back in New York, and she's a painter. And it was all about, you know, Picasso and Rothko have nothing on this. And then we wind up in Dubrovnik, in a cafe in Dubrovnik, because my sweetheart's Croatian-American. And so it's very stream of consciousness. And then it was like, let's play the Tarantella. Let's play one.
I'm glad you gave me the pun there with the because I didn't know. Right, this is our only real thing that we're going to talk about that you wrote lyrics for, even though you are one of your many multi-hyphenate thing is a poet, and you have actual poems stuck in your first album just in between things. And so this is hardly, you know, the most elaborate or demonstrative example of your poetry, but it's something in the sort of Leonard Cohen vein. I say that not only because of your style of singing here.
I hope that I'm a more melodic singer, maybe, than, I don't know if I'm more evocative singer than Leonard. I adore Leonard, but I started out as a poet. Those poems that you hear on Midnight Snack were recorded at Jack's Tracks in Nashville, Tennessee, by Jim Rooney, Jack being Cowboy Jack Clement. I was down there because I was meeting and playing with John Prine. They had a little time because in between sessions, and the wonderful Jim Rooney, producer Jim Rooney, who produced and discovered Nancy Griffith and produced John Prine and Townes Van Zandt, said, hey, go in there and read some of your poems. So I did. And I mean, I started out writing poetry before. And the first thing that I could do was maybe I could, like Bob Dylan, I could take a blues song and stretch a poem into a blues song.
Sure.
You know, because I didn't know how to write a melody. I could play the blues. And I realized through Dylan that, you know, some of these blues, like, you know, Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat, could get pretty wild, you know. And that's how I wrote the Atomic Mama Nuke Me Till I Glow on my very first album, backed by the Violent Femmes. That's just one of those Dylan-esque surrealistic blues songs.
Right. When you're fitting elaborate lyrics into a blues song, right, you have this pre-made package that you can, and I hear you do that over, you know, that, okay, let's take something that sounds sort of like a Who song or like a Stone song that's not a blues one, but that you can still do that. And with this, it's in the same category as the folk stuff for me, that if you're doing Eastern European folk song or an Indian folk song, or, well, here is the 1960s Italian framework. Let's just slot this thing in there. And I'm really glad you explained to me that it eventually gets to the Tarantella / Tarantula, because I didn't know lyrically, why is the spider bite thing right in here? Oh, okay. It is eventually explained, or at least you've explained it now.
Right. So I didn't know the story of the tarantula bite and the tarantella. I didn't know it. And when I saw it, it was so deeply inspiring, especially in this setting that looked like it could have been a Fellini film or something. I mean, the thing about Italy to me is that Fellini didn't invent anything. He was a documentarian. I mean, everything is just happening in its own beautiful, strange way in Italy. And that was part of it, you know. And romantic, well, goodness gracious, you know, what an incredibly romantic place. So a little love song for Italy and my sweetheart and all of that.
Let me play a little bit of the chorus.
Well, I wanna know, where does the time go? 'Cause it feels like forever, forever ago.
Yeah, so this is the part that's not the traditional Italian thing, at least as far as this is just more of a songwriting thing. Yeah, any thought of, like, we're going to take this trope and sort of make it resolve to this?
You're really funny. You're great. I never think like this. I mean, I think like that maybe when I'm writing one of my musical biographies of Townes Van Zandt or Roy Orbison, or my most recent one that's coming out next winter on Reverend Gary Davis. Oh. I think analytically on that level, when I'm writing music and playing music, the one thing about improvising, by the way, is if you stop to think, it's over. It's absolutely over. You can't stop to think about what you play. It's left you in the dust. It's already over. They're gone. And when I'm writing music or writing songs or melodies or whatever it is, that stream of consciousness, that's heart. I couldn't possibly tell you how I wrote that song.
Well, that's part of the fun of doing an analysis after the fact like this, is it's not, you're not polluting it retroactively. It's just your past self.
Yeah, but I just can't even tell you. I don't know.
Yeah, so I'm not asking you to recreate your mode and because I want to write exactly that. It's just more that this is a very nice, singable, straightforward chorus put in the middle of here.
That's what I was looking for. Who knows where the time goes? Is maybe along with God only knows, Brian. Sorry.
Yes, we are recording this on the day of Brian Wilson's death, and in fact delayed the recording by an hour due to that fact. So please take your time.
Sorry for getting dramatic, but Brian Wilson is one of my truest heroes, and I'm not talking about get around, get around, I get around.
No, the God only knows that. What I would do without you is yeah. This is what I'm saying is sort of cutting through in this kind of chorus.
Thank you. It's the highest of the high to me. And that you even mentioned Leonard Cohen and Brian Wilson, and that I can't even begin to talk about how important Pet Sounds was to me, as far as hearing. I learned how to hear from that record. I learned so much about how to hear music and what to look for in hearing music. It's a funny thing. My good friend and musical brother, Willie Aaron, had a gig this last week playing with Ruth Ann Friedman, who wrote Windy. And Van Dyke Parks was playing piano with Ruth Ann. And they were driving over with Stevie Kalanick, who wrote lyrics with Brian Wilson, who's a dear friend and is in his 80s. And I'm sure this is a devastating loss for him. And they were driving over to the gig, and Willie looks at Stevie, and he's playing Bach's Goldberg Variations by Glenn Gould. And he says, Brian is one of the very few people that ever created music on the level of Bach. And there was no exaggeration there. I adore Brian Wilson. And I'm friends with Al Cooper. And I did a really big interview with Al Cooper called Cooper Remembers, a two-part interview for Please Kill Me. And I spent the weekend up there with him. And he had all these photographs of him with everybody, with Elton John, with B.B. King, with George Harrison, with Lynyrd Skynyrd, who he produced, with everybody. He had photographs. Oh, he was telling me about recording all those years ago with George Harrison. He comes into the studio. There's George. There's Ringo. There's Paul. I said, holy shit, man. Was that the absolute apex of your musical career and life? And he goes, nah.
Just a session.
I go, really? Well, what the hell was? He said, working with Brian Wilson.
One of the great things about Brian Wilson is how much he experimented, you know, why the Pet Sounds album is so, you know, having the bass harmonica and putting these crazy things in there. Let me just play a little bit right from the end of this song. After the tarantella has started,
tarantella.
So, for instance, do you know what percussion that is? That's not drum kit.
No, it's the biggest tambourine you've ever seen in your
that's
life.
That's what that is. Okay.
It's a tambourine that would probably, I'll find a photograph of it and send it to you. There's a picture of Claudio playing the tambourine. It went from right above his knee to his shoulders.
Okay. That's a very space. Yeah, actually, you live in New York. Do you not have the size that Jeff has that you refer to of instrument? How do you fit all this stuff? Do you have a storage room for it? Do you have a special shed?
It's really odd. I'm not a collector.
Okay.
I've never been a collector, and I don't have a collector's mentality. I don't have a record collection. I tend to live in small spaces, and that has a lot to do with it. But I'm not a collector. I'm a toolkit guy. All my stuff is used as my sonic toolkit. I only keep whatever I use.
So even like as a harmonica guy, you know, I had a harmonica guy in a band, and he had his case of all the different keys of harmonicas. Like, how many harmonicas are you sporting generally? Just like
maybe
a couple?
Seven.
Oh, okay. So still, that covers the bases pretty well.
Yeah, the ones, the keys that I mostly play in. I have a couple of flutes. I have an alto flute and a regular flute. And I got a bunch of wood flutes, but they stash away pretty well in a drawer. I don't have a lot of mandolins. I only own like three guitars. I don't need them. I have two banjos, you know. One's a 4-string, one's a 5-string.
So even the 12-string is that?
I always have a 12-string wherever I go.
Okay, okay.
That's part of breathing to me. I was a huge Lead Belly fan. I love the Birds. Leo Kottke, who I opened for a number of times. I love double strings. I love mandolin, mandocello, 12-string.
Sure.
I'll play a Telecaster. I like 6-string guitars. I'm not prejudiced.
All right, let's get the third song out there.
Oh, I'm not switching my team to some fancy work platform that somehow knows exactly how we work. And its AI features are literally saving us hours every day. Oh, we're big fans. Just like that, teams all around the world are falling for Monday.com. With intuitive design, seamless AI capabilities, and custom workflow, it's the work platform your team will instantly click with. Head to Monday.com, the first work platform you'll love to use.
So this is, we wanted to hear a Tribecistan tune, and Bedbugs is the one you initially suggested, the one apparently used for a soundtrack, a popular tune from the New Delhi album, 2012. Do you want to say a little about this before we hear it? I had switched to this in our, because you said, oh, it's all mandolin songs, and I thought this had flute in it, but now, well, actually it only has flute at the beginning and a couple times. It's still mostly a mandolin song.
It's a mandolin song. I wrote it in India. I wrote it in India when I was getting absolutely eaten alive by bed bugs in this hotel. And it's funny because it has a West Indies feel and not an East Indies feel.
Well, through some of it, the intro, in fact, those horns in the intro, like, are those even horns or that it sounds like?
No, those aren't horns. That's a bowed instrument. I don't even know what it was.
Okay.
It was something that Jeff had. And I wrote that thing. The intro, that came off of some odd bowed instrument that Jeff had. And with, I think there's a penny whistle on there or something. And then it breaks into kind of a calypso feel.
Yes.
And that's the late, great Claire Daly, who just passed away in October, who played baritone sax with us. And she worked with many wonderful people, including Aretha Franklin and James Brown and Taj Mahal. She was an incredible, wonderful spirit and musician and recently passed away from cancer. And she plays a great solo in that. And that's Scott Metzger. And he's playing bass on there. God, that album is crazy. It's got Bashir Attar from the Master Musicians of Shizuka and Steve Churay playing trombone, and that has tabla on it. I can't remember. Anyway.
Let me play just the beginning again so you can tell me if you can remember what kind of drum this is, because I was interested.
Yeah, that's timbales and drums. And I'm probably playing mandolin, and he's playing that. I'm sorry, I don't know what it was. He had so many odd instruments from different parts of Africa that I never remembered what the hell they were.
So was this band also supposed to be, you're playing everything live?
In particular, that album, what happened with that was Jeff and I started out as a duo. We went into a studio in Brooklyn, and I quickly realized that I need a bass player, or I want a horn on this. And Jeff was like, sure, you know them, bring them in, sure. So after we made the first album, we got this incredible write-up in Jazz Is magazine. Strange sounds coming from Lower Manhattan or something like that. It was the best write-up that I probably had in my career at that point. And they called Tribecistan Zappa-esque, like we were the mothers of world music or something, which is ridiculous because we could never play like the mothers. I got to play with a couple of the guys from the mothers, and I know what kind of musicians they were.
Yeah, there's not the very fast overplaying on this stuff, and most of it has a very funky underlying, like I thought this was the, okay, I'm going to use my musicology background and make a thing that I can actually play at almost any event, play at an outdoor festival. And it's not like, oh, they have to love my singer-songwriter voice or my poet voice. It's just a thing that can be accessible to anybody,
right,
from any background.
I had a fight with Jeff in order to sing on any of the records. He really didn't want any of that. But I had worked out this belly dancing version of Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which is really very cool. So there's one vocal on that record,
which is a good cover version. I really like that. I mean, I always like that song.
Oh, thanks.
Whatever, the Elvis Costello version. And the
Tammy, who sang with Dr. John, is singing with me on that record. I wanted her to sing it. And she's like, oh, no, honey, I love the way you sing. You sing it. I'll sing it with you. And so we did that, and it was like she sang on Right Place at the Wrong Time and all these songs with Dr. John. She was Tammy Lynn. She was just amazing. And so she sang on Daddy Barracuda on that album, too. So anyway, the thing I want to tell you, you like to know where songs come from or how you arrange stuff. That opening lick actually came from a standard double stop Bill Monroe riff that he would use on songs like Lost Highway or that kind of pickup that was, it came off of that. It came off a totally different place. And I probably made a mistake and like just stumbled onto this whole riff. And I was like, oh man, that tune, I love playing that song. And it's always been one of the most popular things I ever play because it's happy music. It makes people happy.
Let me run through, there are about four melodic parts in a row and then the whole thing repeats. Because a lot of instrumental pieces, like lyrical pieces, it's easy for people to break, okay, there's the,
sure,
the verse and the pre-chorus and the chorus and the bridge. And but with instrumentals, they can go so many different directions, but this is still very structured. But it's
very structured. Again, it's written music.
So once we get past that intro, then I call them call and response sections, just because it'll be obvious. But yeah, so here's the first one of those, the A section.
That came off a Bill Monroe lick. That didn't come from Bill Monroe. Just the opening thing of that was kind of like the standard pickup that he would use sometimes, filtered through my ears.
All right, well, here's the second one. So it's the B section. Let's see. Yeah, this is more obviously a call and response. Da, 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 da. And now the horn, the answer. Yeah, any thought about that? You know, putting those two things together. I mean, is that, again, just a stream of consciousness?
This song happened to me when I was 8 years old. I didn't know it yet. I didn't know it for years, but this is what happened to me after Jack Kennedy was shot. Yeah, good response. After Jack Kennedy was shot, we used to go down to Florida for spring training every year and watch the Yanks at spring training. But everybody was so completely devastated that instead of waiting until, like, you know, spring training, my parents thought maybe we should go somewhere else and take a trip. We went to Jamaica. We went to Jamaica in 1960. What year was that? 63. December of 63. I was 8 years old. I saw these guys walking around with, like, maybe one of them had a whistle, but maracas and a guitar, going around the hotels. And they were singing in three-part harmony, and they were playing the happiest, most beautiful, bouncy, light music I ever heard in my life. And the rhythm was stunning. And I was absolutely indoctrinated into Jamaican folk rhythm and sound at that moment. The rest of the vacation meant nothing to me. That meant everything. I followed them around till they let me shake the maracas with them. And that feel has always showed up in my music ever since. And I think, honestly, that was one of my real connections with Ornette, was that we both loved calypso music. And we listened to Lord Flea, who did the really incredible, you know, Love, Love Alone, made King Edward leave his throne. Because Mingus used to call Ornette a calypso musician. And I always loved that rhythm and that feel because it's just pure happiness. So that's where that song really comes from.
So then the third section, I wrote Full On Jamaican. Let's see.
Get the people dancing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's also really nice to have that as like a contrast to all my darker gypsy waltzes. And there's gypsy dances on those records as well. Right after that, we might have played an absolute killer old country waltz that came from Eastern Europe. Let me mention this. One person said that they thought they were listening to a Putumayo sampler when they listened to a Tribecistan album, because every song sounded like it came from a different artist and from around the world. I took that as a huge compliment. You know, I think that if we weren't white and from New York City, not all the band was white, but predominantly white and from New York City, we would have been enormous. Because, as you know, you can't be famous as a world musician and be white and from New York. You don't count.
I don't know. Did you get, hey, this is cultural appropriation? Or it just seems like it's such a mix of stuff.
Oh, yeah, everything. All that. Or that this is fake world music. Or it's like, why is it fake? I'm not trying to copy anybody. I'm just playing what comes out of my instrument. You know, that's what came out of my instrument. I didn't sit down and go, okay, I'm going to make this first part sound like some kind of Ethiopian folk song, and then I'm going to jump into the West Indies. It's not like that. And then the middle section goes free.
Yeah, so right after that happy section, to get out of it, you do something intriguing chords I wrote down.
That's just us loving the Grateful Dead.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just going down the road feeling better, me and my uncle or whatever it is, you know. Certain moments of the Grateful Dead were certainly brilliant. I'm not one to knock them. I mean, I don't like the later music, but, you know, that's just going down the road feeling bad or something, you know, when I listen back to it and I hear it. But what happens the second time around is that Claire Daly takes a solo on a baritone saxophone and it's totally free.
Yeah, yeah, even just determining, like, well, what key is she going to be in? Like, you know, she just, I wrote Lisa Simpson because, you know, that's the thing in the
song
where they just, everything stops.
She would laugh at that. She would laugh at that. But yeah, that's the other thing about the way that I ran the band. All these guys were great jammers. What I learned from Miles Davis as a teenager going to see Miles Davis, he would look at the other musicians and point at his ear, which meant listen. Listen to what other people are playing. Don't just play your own shit. Listen, right? And that's how you interweave and interconnect. And some musicians don't know how to take it. But, you know, I would walk over to them and just tell them, like, drop out, out, you, out, out. Create a totally different dynamic with the band. Shift the gear completely. Drop everybody out. That's the kind of stuff I learned from watching Frank Zappa live and watching Miles Davis live. I went to those shows to enjoy them as much as to learn about how to run a band. And when you make these enormous shifts, it creates dynamics. Remember dynamics, boys and girls? There used to be dynamics in music. There's hardly any dynamic in music anymore. It's all riding on the back of some big fucking beat, excuse me. But there's not those kind of dynamics. I love Kemper Van Beethoven as I do. They never would just drop out and let one person riff like for 30 seconds to a minute and then come back in. And there's so much power in that.
You talked about Folk Orchestra, the very exceptional circumstances of how you had to write that being in bed. With this, I mean, it's, even though it sounds orchestrated, but it sounds like the orchestration is more, okay, here's the two of us. Well, you just add something and you add something and maybe I'll direct you if I don't like what you're doing. But or was it more organized than that in terms of like the guitar coming in for that little juicy lick and then going away? How top down versus group was this?
That song is almost completely live in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd played it a few times, and that take was probably different from the two other takes. And I mean, the breakdown happened in the same place, but knowing Claire, she would never play the same thing twice. And knowing Scotty, I doubt he played the same thing.
He does that little solo thing three times, and it's different every time a little bit.
Right.
And the same with your own mandolin stuff in that vicinity.
That's just kind of how it works. I mean, here's the one thing. You pick people to play with because you trust them. You like what they do and you trust them. Those are the people that you go in the studio with because you know they're going to bring something to the pie, you know, and you got to give them something to work with. And yet you got to set them loose and let them go. That's what, when I saw Sun Ra, Sun Ra would get up from his piano and walk up to like Marshall Allen or John Gilmour, and they would be soloing. And he would put his hands out to, like that, to present them to the audience so that the audience would appreciate and applaud for them. Not every soloist or side guy that I worked with worked in this situation or appreciated the way that I worked or anything like that. One song you might want to check out on your own, by the way, are the two boleros on Folk Orchestra. Mm-hmm. The first bolero is Ravel, and it's improvised.
Just because you guys kind of remember how the melody goes, and so you could just
it's rubato.
Jam on it.
Well, what the band did was create something that was similar to the feel and sound of In a Silent Way. And I just said to Kathy, play Ravel's bolero over this rubato. And she goes, how do you play bolero as a rubato piece? A bolero is a set rhythm. And it's like, how do you play it in a... I just said, don't worry about it. Just play. And we did that. And then that turns into Beck's bolero, which is highly arranged. But the whole first piece of that is completely improvised, except for Kathy, who played Ravel over it. So, you know, I'm searching for the 30-second flavor, man.
So Ravel gets the writing credit, even though...
Sure.
9 out of the 10 people playing were doing was not Ravel.
Right. I'm just, as I said, I'm just searching for the 30-second flavor. And it's like, how you get there is like how you get there. It's like you can think you know what you're doing when you walk into the studio, but there's also those incredible moments where you had no idea that was going to happen. And thank God the tape was rolling.
All right. Well, I will link folks to those dual boleros and some other things that we haven't gotten to cover. Just to say goodbye here and briefly introduce something that we're going to leave people with. We've kept dropping the camper van people's names. Well, what is listed on your Bandcamp as your most recent release, but it's actually a 1995, as you clarify, thing that you, was this released at the time and you're just re-releasing it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. It's not that it was closeted. Yeah. So say a little about this Electric Chairman project and the song Backcountry in particular before we say farewell.
It's really interesting because I realize how I've had a number of health battles throughout life. And in 1995, I was living in Milwaukee. I had been working with Violent Femmes and playing my own gigs there and playing with De Kreutzen, who's a very interesting hardcore band. And I had been living there for about 8 years. And I had gone through a health crisis at the time and really needed to get out of town. And my friend in San Francisco, Cork Markeski, who played on this album called The Electric Chairman, the album was called Toast, The Electric Chairman, Camper Van Beethoven had broken up. I was really wanting to record with them and went out to San Francisco and was on the mend from a thyroid problem I had. And we made this album. It's Jonathan, Victor, and Greg, who I love and adore and have played with for years in all kinds of settings. And that track is very live. That's Connie Champagne, who is a lounge singer in San Francisco, putting the special sauce on that one. But you can hear that's a pretty live track. And what I love about that track, that's a hell of a mandolin solo. That's all I could say. That's one of my favorite recorded mandolin solos. And I play some good harmonica on it. And that was just a jam called Backcountry, inspired by Gary Snyder's book, The Backcountry. And just some down-home funky music. And at the very end, you could hear Jonathan picking up the fiddle on the fade, giving it that feel. And that was a really eclectic, eccentric project. I wrote most of the songs and arranged a lot of the stuff with Jonathan and Victor. And, you know, it came out on the Minute Weasel disc label out of San Francisco at the time. And it was a one-off. We played a couple of shows together. I moved down from San Francisco down to L.A. in 95 because I thought I could get some studio work and wound up going, what the hell am I doing here? And going back to New York City. And that's where I've been ever since.
Well, thanks so much for chatting. It was really great hearing your stories and listening through this crazy variety of styles.
Yeah, that's what I do. Working on my 13th solo album now. So
yeah, what is the style of the new one?
This is a singer-songwriter album. Again, it's closer to Forever Ago in that style, except I'm playing a lot of the instruments with Willie Aaron and Marvin Etzioni. And then there's a couple of tracks left over from Italy that's going on there. Please direct people to my Bandcamp. My website is called Kruthworks, KRUTHWORKS.com. And you'll see my books, my many books. Just finished my 8th book, and not including all the poetry books. You got to stay busy.
All right. And here it is, Backcountry.
The moon is low. Sweet in the back country, and a coyote is the howl all night. The sky is orange in the west. You see forever, honey, from a crow's nest. It's all the stars that twinkle like a Christmas lights. Stars.
Thanks so much to John. Certainly an inspirational voice in getting me to buckle down and practice more instruments. Again, you can learn about him at kruthworks.com, and all his many solo albums are posted either at johncruth.bandcamp.com, or the Tribecistan things are at evergreen, that is greene.bandcamp.com. I hope you're subscribed to the podcast directly, right? If you're just seeing this in the Partially Examined Life feed, you're missing out on the more than 200 previous episodes of this podcast. So go to nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or better yet, patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic to get the ad-free version. Next time, I have an interview with Willie Nile, a wonderful singer-songwriter, also from New York City. And then I just spoke to a gentleman named T. Templeton, who, though he is originally from North Carolina, is also a New York City transplant. So if you're subscribed directly to this podcast, you'll get those episodes promptly. I would love to hear your comments on the show. You can make comments at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or message me through Patreon via mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. I'd love to hear your suggestions on guests. If you want to put yourself forward as a guest, or if you just want to share your experiences with the artists that I've talked to, I have some good news on the personal recording front. We now have basic tracks recorded for half the songs, I believe, on my album, with just a couple weekends of recording. But I'm sure this is going to drag on for months before we have all the layering done. But exciting nonetheless. Hope your summer's going well. Hope you're being creative. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.